Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed. This is our weekly unfiltered episode. Rabia here. I'm here with Colin and Meethal. Hey, guys.
Hey, Rabia. How's it going?
Good. Good, good, good. Snowpocalypse continues.
Even down here in South Carolina?
Yeah. Colin, have you guys gotten dug out? Are you stuck indoors? How's it going?
Yeah, we had canceled classes on Monday, which was two of my classes gone, but we're back on schedule on Tuesday now.
Are you kidding me? A day later, you're back in class?
I mean, things heat up pretty well here, not too long after the temperature gets.
What's the temperature today?
I think we're hitting the low 50s.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No wonder.
I can't complain down here.
Well, 12 days in and my kids still don't have school.
Yeah, that's rough.
So I'm about to move to Florida. So I don't have to do this anymore. Meethal, how you doing?
I'm surviving.
Surviving. All right.
Barely.
Oh, yeah. All the parents of young children right now. That's how we're feeling. All right. So it's been a busy week. A lot's going on. How about Colin, you start for this week.
Yeah.
You start us off on what you want to talk about this week in the news.
So this is a story that is tough for me, and I'm guessing both of you, because it has these two sort of countervailing considerations.
Oh, God. It's always one of those difficult ethical. Speaking of which, wait. Before you get into it, Colin, yeah. Meethal and I went and watched Mercy.
Okay. And verdict?
I liked it. I thought it was a good movie. It doesn't have great ratings on Rotten Tomatoes, apparently, but I really liked it. I thought it was really thought-provoking. Have you seen it yet?
No, I'm going to wait till it comes to Amazon Prime.
Okay. Maybe we'll get into a more lengthy discussion when it comes to it. But I think people who are interested in kind of, you know, ethical concerns around the criminal legal system should check it out. What do you think, Meethal?
I agree. I mean, it's definitely tons of food for thought. And we've talked about a lot of these things anyways, especially on these unfiltered episodes. But yeah, we should table that until he's seen it before we spoil everything.
All right, Colin, back to your ethical, moral morass of the week.
So this is a case from your neck of the woods. And on the one hand, I love a robust Fourth Amendment. I don't like police having broad discretion to pull over vehicles based on what they call reasonable suspicion. On the other hand, I've encountered many distracted drivers who are texting while driving and almost been accidents that I've narrowly avoided. And so Supreme Court of Maryland just last week issued an opinion in State versus Stone. A police officer testified as followed. While we were behind the vehicle going up West North Avenue in the 100th block, I observed the driver. He had a cell phone that was stuck to the windshield of the vehicle. I could see the cell phone illuminated when I was behind it, and I saw him pressing the screen while he was driving. Pull over this driver. Eventually, drugs were discovered. And the question is, seeing someone touch a cell phone screen, is that reasonable suspicion to pull them over? Because you can't text while driving in Maryland. You can use your cell phone as a GPS. I don't do it that way. I have a touch screen, but similar. I've been driving, you know, I'm trying to see the screen to turn on. I might like manipulate, you know, the reverse pinch, the zoom on the touch screen. So majority of the Supreme Court of Maryland says because there are legitimate uses of a cell phone while driving, that by itself is not reasonable suspicion to pull over a vehicle. Dissent says absolutely it's reasonable suspicion to pull someone over. Most uses of a cell phone while driving are illegal. And so, Ravi and Meethal, what are your thoughts? Do you agree with the majority? This is not grounds to pull someone over, seeing them manipulate their cell phone while driving, the screen illuminated. Or do you agree with the dissent? This is enough to be able to pull them over.
Can you tell us a little more specifically about the law that we're talking about here? Does a law prevent?
Yeah.
The law says what? No texting. It says no
texting.
Typing. No what?
You're allowed to use it to use GPS or to contact 911 or other emergency services. You are not allowed to use it for phone calls, to send text messages, etc. while driving.
All right. I asked because first of all, I'm getting some kind of an echo and I hope our listeners don't pick it up, but we're going to proceed. But anyway, apologies if you guys do get it. If I'm driving, I don't text while I drive, generally speaking. It has to be some kind of a, like, you know, if I get some kind of a message that needs an immediate response, maybe. But even then, I'll usually wait till I'm completely stopped somewhere. But what I do is I'm on YouTube looking for songs. That's like my most most common use of my cell phone. Because you know, when you get in the car, you put in your GPS if you don't know where you're going, like if you need the directions, that's already locked in. But I'll be like, I'm in the mood, or my kid wants to hear something, and I'll put, that's really what I'm using. And I'm like, is that allowed or not allowed?
Looking at the statute, it's not specifically mentioned. I'm guessing it's probably not allowed, but I don't know.
I find that unreasonable.
If you were pulled over, do you think you would have grounds to say this is unconstitutional? I was scrolling through YouTube for videos. I wasn't communicating.
I think so. I think it's the communications aspect of it, because you're mentally distracted in a different way than if you're. Well, I don't know. Mitha, what do you think?
I mean, I think no matter what you're doing, whether you're searching for songs, which, I mean, I can appreciate that. Distraction is distraction, right? Of course, if you're texting, if I'm texting and like trying to drive on a highway, like that's crazy and I should get pulled over. And I've done all the things, right? So I think it's fair to pull somebody over, but it's going to be really hard unless they can see my screen what I'm doing, right? Especially from that distance.
That's the tough part, yeah.
Like, so how do you prove what I'm doing? What if I'm just closing apps?
Yeah.
And not even doing anything.
Of course, if you're weaving, you're driving in a fashion that seems consistent with texting, you can be pulled over. This is, you know, someone who otherwise appears to be driving normally and they're on their windshield, you know, touching this screen on the cell phone, it's lighting up. We're not sure what they're doing.
What do you mean? Where's the phone? You're saying on the windshield. I'm confused by that.
Yeah, like, you know, you can get like the suction holders? Cups. You can kind of suction
oh,
it.
Oh, so the phone's up there.
Yeah.
And the person is touching
it. Yeah. And it's
but otherwise,
up.
They're driving okay. There's
they're
no
driving
other indication.
Safely, as far as we can tell. Yeah.
Yeah. That feels like a stretch to me. I mean, I feel like you kind of actually can tell, especially if the phone's up there in a way. Like, if you're driving next to them, like, after, if you observe long enough, I think you might be able to know if it's like whether it's a quick. You know, a quick movement they're doing to fix their GPS or whatever, or reorient or put an address versus an ongoing, like, seems like conversation type. I don't know. I feel like if there are other factors, like you were saying, like they're weaving, they're not staying in their lines, they're missing a stop sign, something like that, then maybe that, I understand, that seems reasonable enough to make the inference that, like, you know.
Well, and also how long have they been followed, right? Has it just been 30 seconds? Have you been following them for 5 minutes, watching them constantly pretend to do something, right?
Yeah.
Like,
I think that's where I kind of fall for both of you, which is, you know, Rabia, we need some other indicia of distracted driving beyond just touching the cell phone. And then Mithil, you know, some period of time as opposed to, I just saw them do this for a second and I'm automatically turning on the lights and pulling them over.
But in this case, it seems like the defendant won this case, right? Is that what you're saying?
The majority of the Supreme Court of Maryland says there were not grounds to stop this vehicle, and therefore, fruit of the poisonous tree, we throw out the drugs that were seized as a result.
Okay.
Pretty broad meeting in the Fourth. I'd be interested to see whether other jurisdictions tackle this, because this was a close call here among the justices.
Yeah. What was the split?
I'm not sure what the actual numerical breakdown wasn't the case, but the dissenting justice, this is sort of the language that they use. They said, by requiring officers to rule out exceptions to the prohibition before making a stop, the Maryland majority is holding effectively neuters Maryland's distracted driving statutes as a tool for preventing tragic auto accidents. It demands too much of officers and thereby elevates the governing standard to something beyond reasonable suspicion.
I mean, here's the thing. To me, in this case, I could be wrong. I don't know all the circumstances here. Mm-hmm. You know, who is the defendant? What does he look like? What neighborhood are we in here?
Right.
It almost feels like a little bit of a pretext to pull them over to do that search.
Yeah.
Versus.
And that's the issue. Yeah. If you authorize it, it does allow for pretext.
Yeah. Okay. Somewhere in the middle, I think, is where we land. Because I want to look for my YouTube videos. And yes, Mithil, you're right. I shouldn't be looking for. I should have my playlist in order. But sometimes your mood changes.
That's why.
And you want a different song?
I'm the worst. My playlist is random. So you will go from the most depressing thing to, yes, now we're in a club. Like, it makes no sense.
Keep your nervous system guessing. That's really good for your hormones. When it comes to dog food, it seems like you have to make a choice. You can either have the fresh and healthy option, or you can have the easy to store and serve option. But in the past, you could never have both. Now, though, you don't have to choose anymore, thanks to Sundays. Sundays was founded by a veterinarian and mom, Dr. Tori Waxman, who got tired of seeing so-called premium dog food full of fillers and synthetics. So she designed Sundays, air-dried real food made in a human-grade kitchen using the same ingredients and care that you would use to cook for yourself and your family. Every bite of Sundays is clean and made from real meat, fruits, and veggies, and no kibble. That means no weird ingredients that you can't pronounce and no fillers. Compared to kibble or other brands out there, Sundays invests 50 times more in its ingredients to ensure premium quality. Because your dog deserves food made with care, not in the interest of cost-cutting. And the best part? You just scoop and serve. There's no freezer, there's no thawing or prep, there's no mess. Just nutrient-rich, clean food that fuels their happiest, healthiest days so you get more of them to share together. And I love that Sundays was developed and founded by a veterinarian because I'm the daughter of a veterinarian, and I watched my father over the lifetime of his career always start by counseling his clients to feed their pets the best, most nutritious, healthy, fresh foods. Because he always said you cannot overstate the importance of a clean, healthy diet to the health of your pet. With Sundays, you're going to find that your dog has more energy, has a better mood, they're more calm and focused, their coat's going to be softer, less itching, less allergies, no eye boogers, even better stools. So make the switch to Sundays. Go right now to sundaysfordogs.com/justice50 and get 50% off your first order. Or you can just use the code justice50 at checkout. That's 50% off your first order at sundaysfordogs.com/justice50. That's 50-50. sundaysfordogs.com/justice50 or use code justice50 at checkout. Mito, you want to go next?
Okay. So I'm sure everyone has watched the Today Show at some point and are familiar with one of their co-hosts, Savannah Guthrie. She's been there for in that role, at least for over a decade now. Well, this past Sunday, Savannah's 84-year-old mother, Nancy Guthrie, went missing. She was out with family Saturday night. They dropped her off to her house. She lives just outside of Tucson, Arizona. And, you know, the next day she planned to go to Sunday service like she usually did. However, this time she didn't show up. Since she's a regular there, somebody from the church contacted her family to say, hey, she didn't come. Like, is everything okay? So the family immediately goes to her house. She's not there. They look around the property. They're not able to locate her after, you know, looking around for a while. And so they ultimately call the police. The police arrive and, you know, they're brought up to speed about what's going on. And they initiate a search and rescue mission. A little bit later in the evening, because it happens overnight almost, and they've got dogs, helicopters, drones, like all the things, but they still can't locate Nancy. Now, while that's happening, they're also obviously looking inside the property and around, and they see some things that were, quote, concerning. And in turn, now they start, they change from this, you know, a missing person case, and now they're considering this as a possible kidnapping or abduction. But because it's still an active investigation, the sheriff is tight-lipped and isn't given much detail. However, he does say that there's possible DNA evidence that's been collected. Now,
I've seen
one article, I think it's unofficial, that says that blood was found in the home, but there's no indication of, you know, whose blood it was. Was it fresh? Was it old? Like, so we'll see if the sheriff's department speaks to that in the future. Now, of course, when anybody goes missing, it's a cause for concern, but in this case, Nancy's cognitively still very sharp, so it's not like, you know, an elderly person with dementia who just walked off.
A dementia issue.
That's not the case. Now, physically, she's got some limitations in terms of her mobility, and so that's why the authorities are thinking, okay, this is a case of kidnapping, because she wouldn't have even been able to walk far on her own, maybe 50 yards or so. So she needs support to even walk, you know, on the regular. And her wallet, cell phone, car, everything is still at the house.
I was going to say, when a robbery or
a home invasion.
There you go. No. Nobody know what is leaving their home. No woman is running away from home without all that stuff. Yeah.
Exactly. Now, the family.
But there's
also
no robbery either.
No.
Interesting.
Nothing's missing.
What about
like
cameras?
That? Yeah, they're looking into that. Okay. So the family is also pressing the authorities because there's an additional sense of urgency because there's some medication that she takes that was at the house along with the rest of her stuff. And if she doesn't take it on a daily basis, it could be fatal. So they do have her cell phone. So obviously they're looking through that. Security camera footage from the house, from their neighbors' homes, because they've done the door-to-door knocking already. Apparently they're using some license plate readers because they're not clear if there's a car involved. And she does live alone, but she has house staff. So even those folks have been talking to the authorities. Still no luck. The sheriff's department has set up a tip line. They've got a QR code link where people can share any pictures, videos, anything that, that they may, you know, I think I saw Nancy X or whatever. And there's a reward that they're even offering, up to $2,500. So while the sheriff is talking to NBC News, they're appealing to the potential abductor and saying, quote, just call us, let her go, just call us. The family will tell you there's no questions asked here. So
what? Oh, yeah.
Could this be sure. a ransom case? Does this have something to do with Savannah Guthrie? There are no known threats against Nancy or anybody else in the family. And obviously, it's still an active investigation. We're only days into it. So, I'm sure there's going to be a lot more updates. But yeah, somebody potentially has kidnapped an 84-year-old,
wow.
you know, grandmother.
Had you heard about this, Colin?
Actually, Zoe just had the press conference on. She was watching it as she was about to start lunch when I came in here. So, yeah, that was what I had heard on. And I saw something about her pacemaker stopped syncing with her Apple Watch. I don't think that was in the press conference. I think I just pulled that up before I came on here. So, yeah, I mean, really interesting.
Her Apple Watch is at home and her pacemaker is no longer syncing with it. That's what you're saying?
I'm not sure entirely. I just saw the
I mean, the pacemaker's in her body.
I assume that they're not together. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That just stopped syncing.
That's crazy. Do you know? I mean, I know maybe all the details are not public yet, but like how late she was dropped off the night before? Do we know for sure she was dropped off the
night
before?
She was definitely dropped off. Again, because she's got difficulty walking, she was walked into her house around 9:30, 9:45 p.m. So they don't even know, you know, if this was a kidnapping. They don't know exactly what time it could have happened because it was around 11 a.m. on Sunday when they got a call saying, hey, she didn't show up to church.
Yeah. So I have a question for this, Meethal and Rabia, from Meethal, what you just said, which is to say, obviously the family's saying, just return her and you'll be okay. Should the prosecutor have the power if a family comes to them in a kidnapping case and say, listen, this is actually legitimate. Like here, we'll post it on this immunity. If you return this person back healthy, they are immunized from prosecution. Like, I would be happy if that happened to a family member and I were allowed to work with the prosecution. There could be a legal decree saying, if you return the family member and they're healthy, there's not going to be charges pressed. Fair game, or is that something that we shouldn't endorse in the legal system?
I feel like I'm in law school every week with Colin on this stuff. Look, as somebody, like, obviously, if you are the family member of a victim, I completely understand wanting to do that. I would do that. I mean, God forbid if it was a child or, you know, anybody close to you, you'd be like, yeah, just no questions asked. All you want at the end of the day is the health and life of that victim. So I get it. It's interesting. So in the framework of Islamic legal jurisprudence, it allows, and I don't know about other kinds of crimes, but specifically in the crime of murder, a family can decide to forgive the murderer to spare their life so they're not executed. That is completely on the family. And if they're not executed, they in fact don't even serve time in prison, because the only, under the Islamic jurisprudence, only punishment for murder that you've been convicted of is death. Like, that's it. There's no life imprisonment.
Uh-huh.
But the family is allowed to say, no, we forgo that. We don't want to put this person to death. And the state has to comply. And that's like in the most severe instance, you know, and you're letting a murderer go free. So I guess in principle, I get it. But yeah, that could also wreak havoc on the system. I mean, maybe, I don't know.
Who's to say that they don't do it again, right? I mean,
true.
On an emotional level, of course, you don't have to think twice about it. You can go wherever you want to go. Just give me my, you know, whoever back. That's on an emotional level. Again, that's easy. let them go. Just give my family member back. But they could just go all around the world. Not to say that they would do that, but like, right. You know.
Well, prosecutors do this all the time. Look, if we look at Adnan's case, right? Bilal, do you know how many times he got away with stuff and how many people he victimized going on because he kept getting these deals cut? They make deals all the time. So I feel like if a family says, I want you to make this deal so I can get my person back, then why not? Why should only the state have that power to do that?
Well, but again, using Bilal as an example, had he been charged, had he been behind bars, right. So many other kids would not have been affected, right? They wouldn't have been hurt.
That's true. But unless you're able to take all of that off the table for prosecutors, and that's never going to happen. I mean, they're always going to have the power to be like, we're not going to charge you. We're not going to ask for certain sentences. We're going to, you know, I mean, like they do this every single day. That's part of their job. So I feel like as long as they have the power, the family should have some power here too. What do you think, Colin?
I mean, I see pros and cons. I mean, I think overall, for the reasons Methil just noted, it's too dangerous and it could incentivize people. Okay, well, I can do something like a kidnapping, and as long as the family wants them back, I can get this amnesty and immunity. So,
but what would they get out of it? What would they get out of it? Like, if they're not going to get a ransom, they're just going to like go through the trouble of kidnapping somebody and give them back. I feel like that's not it wouldn't be something that would either be a deterrent or encourage somebody to kidnap. I can always return them. I don't think so.
It's a good point. I think you might have swayed me back. I don't know. It's tough.
But what
to
if
say.
It is a ransom?
I'd have to think through it some more.
What if it is a ransom?
Right. But let's say that they do not get the ransom and the family and the state are like, you're not going to get your ransom, but we're not going to prosecute you. Just return this person. And they're like, okay. And they do it. What I'm trying to say is like in the scenario that Colin, you know, suggested, is somebody going to be like, well, I'm going to go ahead and kidnap this person for a ransom because I can always return them.
Yeah. Test the waters.
I mean, if the person's unharmed, you know, but I don't think anybody's going to. I don't think anybody's going to be like, and also this is not, it's not like it's a law that's going to pass. You don't know if the family's going to be on board with it. You don't know if the state's going to be, this is like I don't know.
That movie, All the Money in the World, the Getty abduction where they wouldn't pay the ransom at all.
Yeah. There are families like that. I mean, and then there's so many cases we see, like, especially with death penalty cases where the families of the victims are begging, do not execute this person. Do not. And the state just doesn't like. I feel like I do think there should be some deference given to the families of the victims in these situations.
But see, at the same time, usually when the families are saying, like, spare them their life, it is because they have gotten their family member back, right? So they are emotionally, like, whole again.
No, No. A person's being executed because the family member died, the victim died.
No,
I'm talking about a death penalty case in which somebody, a victim has died, and then the perp is being put to death.
Okay, no, I was talking about the previous one that we were talking about. Like, if I ask for a ransom, and I'm not going to give you the ransom, but I'll give you your family member back, as long as I get immunity. In those cases, like, it's like, for a family member is making that decision because they're emotional about it. Lawyers are not going to be emotional about it, right? The courts are not going to be emotional. They're just like, okay, what's for the greater good and all the people, like, what makes the most sense? There's no emotion involved.
Tough one. Yeah.
I mean, look, in a kidnapping situation, right, or in a hostage situation, even, like people who are, like, working it immediately, let's say they're talking to the hostage taker, whatever, like, in that moment, all they're thinking about is the safety of the victim or the person who's been, they're not thinking about the greater good in that, right? And hostage negotiators can negotiate all kinds of things to make sure that one person is extracted safely. So once again, why can't the family have some similar power to that, right? Like, I don't know. I feel like the state does that on some level anyways. I don't know. But back to her mother's, I guess, abduction. If she can't walk, of course there's a car involved unless somebody's biking her away, Nancy, right? So there must have been.
But again, I think that's where the sheriff doesn't want to share anything yet because they're still trying to figure out what's going on.
I'm sure there's ring camera footage.
I was
going to
say, there's got to be so much footage. It's just weird to me that they haven't, like, it's been a couple of days and they haven't tracked down. Well, or maybe they know who did it, but they're not saying it yet.
Could be. And it's a nice neighborhood, $1 million houses, like, you know, it's...
There's cameras everywhere.
There's cameras, exactly. Yeah. There's plenty of footage.
Any chance this was random, or are we thinking this is definitely targeted?
Oh, I don't know. There's no known threats against any of them, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not because, you know...
I feel like it's a family member.
Oh, wow.
And the reason I say that is because they have to know the schedule. They have to know when this like woman is coming and going and who's in the property and the staff. She's got staff. She's probably got a certain kind of security system set up. I feel like it's somebody who knocked on the door and she opened the door because she knew them or something like that. I mean, like if it's like 9:30, 10 o'clock at night and a stranger knocks on your door, you're not opening that door. I'm not opening that door. Most women would not open that door.
So maybe there's forced entry.
Oh, I don't know if there's signs of forced entry or not.
There's nothing official that says so. But
yeah, okay, so let's say there's...
Well, she is, what, 85? Different generation?
84,
different expectations about letting people in than we have?
My mother wouldn't let people in the middle of the day when she was alive. I don't know. I just feel like... Or if somebody was already in the house when she got there, right? Like, and maybe she interrupted a robbery or something, which I think is also... But nothing was taken.
But then why take her instead of the stuff?
Why take her? Yeah, that's why I'm like, taking her to me feels like, I don't know, some kind of very deeply personal thing. I guess we will find out soon. All right. Which also reminds me of Rob Reiner's, murder and his wife's murder. Like, you know, there could be some financial motives here that we're not aware of. Mental health issues. Who knows? Families are crazy, man. All right. Every group has someone who insists on doing things the hard way. You know, that friend still paying for a subscription they forgot they had. Or that one refusing to update their phone because it still works. I used to be that person too, especially when it came to overpaying for wireless. Then I switched to Mint Mobile and I'm so glad. Would you believe that I was with the same carrier for like almost 15 years and it was just complete inertia? No reason to stay with that carrier, especially not given the high rates. I just didn't take the initiative to finally save myself some money and do the right thing until I recently switched over to Mint Mobile. Mint Mobile is the premium wireless that you expect with unlimited talk, text, and data, but at a fraction of what others charge. And for a limited time, you can get 50% off 3, 6, or 12-month plans of unlimited premium wireless. You can even bring your own phone and number, activate with an eSIM in minutes, and start saving immediately. There are no long-term contracts, and there's no hassle. Plus, Mint Mobile has a 7-day money-back guarantee and customer satisfaction ratings in the mid-90s. That is because Mint makes it easy to try it and see why people don't go back. My Mint Mobile service gives me the same reliable coverage, same speed, without the inflated price tag. I am now paying, I kid you not, a fraction of what my monthly cost used to be. And well, in this day and age, we can all stand to save a few bucks. Are you ready to stop paying more than you have to? New customers can make the switch today. And for a limited time, you get unlimited premium wireless for just $15 a month. That's $15 a month. Switch now at mintmobile.com/undisclosed. That's mintmobile.com/undisclosed. Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for a 12-month plan required, which is a $15 month equivalent. Taxes and fees extra. Initial plan term only. Over 50 gigabytes may slow when network is busy. Capable device required. Availability, speed, and coverage varies. Additional terms apply. See mintmobile.com. All right, I'll wrap up with what I want to talk about, which was last week, two independent journalists, along with five other people, were charged with some federal charges in connection to an incident that took place on January 18th. So I'll start there. On January 18th, at the city's church in St. Paul, there were protesters who entered the church, okay? And they entered the church because the pastor of the church apparently is a field agent or the director of the ICE, field office there, That's actually accurate. So there's this big protest happening. They enter the church. They disrupt the services. Don Lemon and Georgia Fort, who are both independent Black journalists, were there covering the protests. And also they went all the way up into the church. They were interviewing the pastor. They're there interviewing like protesters or covering it, right? Anyhow, after that, seven people in total were charged under two different federal laws for that entire incident. The other five were people who were protesters and organizers of the protest, but Don Lemon and Georgia Fort were two journalists. Okay. Now, apparently what happened was federal prosecutors initially asked for arrest warrants. They asked these federal magistrates for arrest warrants for Lemon and Fort, and they were denied. Then they appealed that and they were denied again. So then they went ahead and put together a federal grand jury. The grand jury indicted both journalists and they were arrested this last week. They have been released on bond, but they face charges. So I wanted to talk about, there's a lot of confusion about what the charges are. I wanted to talk about the two like kind of laws that they're being charged under. And then I also have like a little bit of an ethical question here for you guys. So the laws that they're charged, and the first one is called the FACE Act, the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Law. Okay. It was passed in 1994 to ensure that patients who were seeking care at abortion clinics, as well as doctors and nurses and providers who worked there, could access the facility so that protesters would not be able to block them, right? Like block patients and providers from entering the facility. They could protest. They had to protest at a distance. They could not block the facility. Okay. Then there was a Republican-sponsored clause that added to that act. And it said that, okay, not only for abortion centers, but also for places of worship have to deserve the same kind of protection. So protesters could not block access to these places of worship. All right. Now, generally speaking, that clause in which places of religious worship are also protected under the FACE Act have not been, it hasn't been invoked a lot for that. It's almost always invoked to protect like access to abortion care. And in fact, but at the same time, like last year, Trump pardoned a bunch of people who were convicted under this act for blocking clinics. And then his DOJ has also scaled back the use of the act, saying that there had been like a weaponization of the law. So we're not going to really enforce it anyhow. So that's the one act that they've been charged under, that they were basically blocking access to this, religious worship space. That this law has been used before in the context of blocking religious spaces. I think like rarely, but in one instance, I believe it was like in the last year or two, because there were protesters who were blocking access, or protesters outside of a synagogue. And they were pro-Palestinian protesters, and they have been charged under this act. All right. The second act is the one that people are hearing a lot about, and they're calling it the KKK Act of 1871, but it's also known as the Conspiracy Against Rights Law. And this was a law that was enacted after the Civil War, and it was designed initially to prevent vigilante groups like the Ku Klux Klan from intimidating and preventing other people from exercising the constitutional rights. So the Klan had been targeting, you know, newly freed slaves. And then, you know, they were, for example, preventing people from registering to vote, right? Or otherwise going to school, otherwise constitutionally protected activity. So this law basically prohibits intimidating and otherwise preventing someone from exercising any constitutional right. This law here has been applied. I mean, it's just, it feels obviously very ironic and dystopian that two Black independent journalists are being charged under what's called the KKK Act. And that's the thing that really has people up in arms. But what they're saying is that, you know, there was constitutionally protected worship happening, and these two journalists were part of this group that were preventing them from exercising their constitutional rights. So those are the two basic like frameworks under which they're being charged. So here's my question to you. Did you guys actually get to watch any of the footage of Lemon and Georgia Fort in that church?
I watched it, yeah.
Okay. They're in the church. Clearly, it is clear that they are not part of the protesters. Like, you know that. They are, however, in the worship space. And I think that's where I wonder is like, and by the way, these charges are unprecedented. No journalist has ever been charged for any kind of civil rights violations like this. Journalists have gotten charged in the past for things like trespassing or failure to disperse when authorities are telling them to disperse. But under a civil rights act, like this is kind of unprecedented. So, Colin, what do you think about the fact that they were not just reporting from outside? They actually went up into the church.
Yeah. And so after watching the video, what I immediately did was look to the statutory section. So it's 18 U.S. Code Section 241 and 18 U.S. Code Section 247. And what I found interesting is both of them have an intentional mens rea. So mens rea is mental
state. Get ready for it's a legal education, folks. So, okay, mens rea, yeah.
Right. So this is what I teach my students. So an intentional mens rea is a conscious goal or objective. One step down is a knowing mens rea, which is conscious awareness. And so imagine that I have a feud with my neighbor who is a physician who performs abortions, or I have a feud with my neighbor who's a pastor at the local church. And I, because I hate them independently, shoot them as they're entering or in the church or the abortion clinic. Certainly, I'm guilty of murder. If I'm prosecuted under violating these sections of the U.S. Code, my intention was not to stop the abortion or to stop the pastor from leading religious groups. I knew it would happen. I had awareness by killing this person, I would interrupt it and interfere. My goal was not to interrupt the parishioners worshiping or this procedure taking place. And so, Rabia, that's my big question here. I don't know. I saw the video. I don't know all the planning and all of that. Their goal, at least according to them, I think, is to protest what's going on in terms of ICE and everything and everything else. It might be tough beyond anything else for the prosecution to prove the goal of Don Lemon or anyone protesting or covering the protest, et cetera. Their goal was to interfere with prayer and religious services. So that's sort of my initial take, is that intentional mens rea for anyone might be tough to prove.
Can I ask you, does that mens rea have to, I mean, would it be possible, for example, Don Lemon is a very outspoken critic of Donald Trump and his policies and everything ICE is doing, and obviously the history is right there on his social media. Could that be used to prove his intention? That you already have a history of, you know, hating on ICE and you know, like advocating against ICE and, you know, calling for the abolishment of ICE. So,
but that's, see, that could be used by the defense potentially to say, look, this was against ICE. It was against Trump. Yes, the result was it interfered with religious services, but Don Lemon's goal was not to stop these people from praying and having their regular religious services. His goal was to protest and to go against Trump and ICE. It was not to interrupt. He knew it would interrupt it, but if he didn't have that intention to interrupt this, you know, their praying, etc., I'm not sure. I haven't gone through all the cases. That I'm just saying that might be a viable defense there.
Is that a say? Would that defense work for the other protesters, though?
Again, if their goal, if they're saying our goal is to protest, we hate what's going on with ICE, etc. We're happy with people having religious observations. That wasn't our goal. We knew it would happen. It wasn't our goal.
But the means of the but it was. Come on, the means of the protest is to interrupt a religious ceremony where the. Services where the pastor is the head of ICE in the area. I mean, the method of protesting was to interrupt a religious ceremony.
That's where it gets tough. And so I by no means am I saying it's going to be a winning defense, but I'm saying I could at least see that being something that's raised by Don Lemon and the other defendants.
Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously there's, it feels very targeted. And of course, it feels even more so because they are independent Black journalists. It also feels a little bit like a threat to other journalists who show up and are doing, you know, what they are protected by the Constitution to do. But it, do you feel like it's completely unfounded, I guess is my question, Colin. Do you think there's a little bit of a there? Like, they're kind of testing the waters with this.
Yeah, I mean, it's, listen, I, from what I've seen online, right, there's the video. We see what happened. What was the plan? You know, what was the intent? What was the plan going in with this protest? That's the part of it I don't know. I know, I think it was the indictment was posted online. I haven't read the full indictment, so I can't say everything that happened before the actual protest. Certainly, there's a possibility this is overreaching and this is going too far, but I just don't know enough to be able to say definitively what the intention was and what they were thinking going into it.
I mean, the penalty for violating, I mean, the FACE Act, I think, is up to a year, but the yeah. other one, the KKK one, I think it can be up to 10 years. And then
now, of course, we have jury nullification as well, which we've discussed, right?
Which
and
we have discussed.
Whether a jury in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, whether
right.
you can find 12 people who are all going to be, you know, okay with what's going on, that's probably doubtful given what's
the circumstances.
On the
yeah. yeah. Mito, your thoughts?
I mean, I was just going to say, it just like a lot of the current events, it's so much just seems targeted, right? Like, if they, and since I haven't seen the video, I can't comment on that, but if they're in the church, but they're just talking to people and interviewing and they're not part of the crowd, so to speak, then come on, like, you just don't like the guy. And so you're coming up with something, just like you kind of have been with a lot of things, to see if it sticks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The tough part, Robbie, you mentioned, it's sort of the two hats thing, right? Like, I imagine these cases at synagogues, it's targeted because these people hate the Jewish faith. Mm-hmm. The KKK, obviously their activities are because they hate people who are people of color or Jewish people again. Here, they are targeting this guy, but in his capacity working with ICE,
mm-hmm.
not in his capacity leading a congregation. That's kind of the tricky part there, right? Mm-hmm. It does have the effect of interrupting the services, but their activities are focused upon, you know, like my neighbor's playing loud music and is an abortion doctor. When I kill him,
it's because of the music.
It's not because he's performing abortions. It's because of the loud music. When they're interrupting these services, it's not because he's leading the congregation. I mean, I assume there's nothing in the prayers having, maybe it is, having to do with what's going on the ground. But
right.
if it's having to do with the Bible, like, that's not what they're targeting.
Yeah.
That's the tricky
and
yeah.
And to be fair, like, we don't know. I mean, I don't know all the circumstances. It could be that the yeah. protesters have been there before and calling on the congregants to, like, you know, I mean, I know there have been calls for him to resign. It could be that they are putting a lot of pressure on the worshipers there. Like, I don't really know, like, the broader yeah. context. I think when it comes specifically to the journalism aspect of this, on one hand, it's like, well, of course you need the media to go into the space to be able to accurately report on what happens inside. Otherwise, you could have, like, it would all be like he said, she said, like, you know, did they damage things? Did they attack people? Did they not? Like, how did it all go down inside the space? On the other hand, I'm like, maybe they shouldn't have gone inside and just reported from outside. I mean, I don't know. I don't know. What do you think about that?
But are you allowed to go inside? You are, right? Does it matter as long as you're not being disruptive to, you know, those that are in prayer or a
You can't, like, I know. Look, I generally speaking, in a place of worship, like, you have to get permission to go in with cameras. I know because, like, there are times when people have just randomly tried to film at a mosque and they're like, no, you got to get permission before you come up in here with cameras. So I know there are a lot of places have policies like that. It's a little trickier than I think on the face than you think. Like, you, because your visceral reaction is, well, this is just, well, it is definitely still targeted. But maybe it's not complete BS. Like, there might be a way they can, yeah, they have a case here. I don't know. All right. It'll be interesting to follow. In the meantime, both Georgia Fort and Don Lemon have said that they will not stop their work. They're not going to be intimidated. They're going to continue to report from where they believe it's important to report.
Well, do you know, I mean, Robbie, I didn't follow this at all, but, like, wasn't that, like, it went to a magistrate and the magistrate said there wasn't probable cause to arrest, but I don't know what the basis for that finding was. Do you know?
I believe it was that he found that there was no criminal activity on the part of the journalists.
Just the journalists.
Yeah. Okay. But but criminal activity is different than, like, well, no, I guess. Yeah, that's what he said. The warrant application, my understanding, was for Lemon and Fort.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's that. All right, guys. Well, that was a nice, tight, short episode. I'm sure you guys have lots of other stories you want us to cover. Drop them in our DMs, post them on our Facebook. We will try to cover as many as we can. But that would probably require us to do one of these every single day. An unfiltered episode every single day. All right, guys. Thanks so much. And I'll see you guys in another week then.
See you later.
Have a good week.
All right, you too.
Take care.
Bye.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/towardjustice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered 1 or 2. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with 3 different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being $1, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Romero Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.